Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. AlphaList is a closed community with over 400 CTOs who share their knowledge and experience in a Slack space and at events. With this podcast, we want to give our members and interested parties insights into the thoughts and ideas of top CTOs. If you're interested in becoming a member of the community, please visit alphalist.com to find out more on how to apply. Thanks a lot to our sponsor, The About You Cloud. The About You Cloud offers a full-stack e-commerce solution as a service that runs on exactly the same infrastructure as the About You Shop does. It is mobile-first, can act as headless system, event-driven, can be fully localized, and is super integrated into existing solutions. Besides that, it is designed and developed by a really smart CTO and friend of mine, Sebastian Betz. About You has set up a task force for retailers and brands that want to be quick in the COVID situation. This task force will help you with the launch of your shop, as well as with fulfillment, marketing support, and internationalization. Simply write to hello@aboutyou.com to be supported by this task force. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. Today, I'm talking to an absolute legend. He's wearing a very progressive long haircut, is from the gaming industry, and invented the game Doom in the 90s. Guess who? Right? I'm talking about John Romero. So, John, maybe you want to start with the number of copies you sold all over your gaming history.
Oh, geez, millions. I have no idea. Enough that I can keep on making games. That's all that matters.
So that is what is sticking, right?
Yeah, totally. So you were asking about like what was it like developing, just the process of development. Luckily I started learning how to code just 2 years after the beginning of the software industry that began in 1977. The introduction of what was called the Holy Trinity of home computers had arrived with the TRS-80, the Apple II, and the Commodore PET. And those computers were the very first ones that people could actually easily buy, just take home and start using. And in 1979, kind of crazily, I was 11 years old and I was addicted to arcade games, and I wanted to play all the time. So I had jobs where I could make money and just spend it all at the arcades. And one day my brother and my friend Rob came to the house and said, "We found a place where you can play games with no money." And I'm like, "Oh my God, let's go." So we rode our bikes. I followed him all the way to the local college. And we went into the computer science.
I thought you ended up in a shopping center or something.
I know. I would like expect an NES on the table. That's what I was hoping. I was hoping that was going to happen. But no, we went to the computer science building and leaned our bikes up against the outside, went inside, and saw all these terminals. You know, and a few students. It was the summertime. Not that many people doing work during the summer. And we just got on one of the terminals, and my friend Rob had access to. He had the login and password to an account. So we got on there and basically was starting to play these games on a mainframe. And one thing led to another. I wanted to make games because these were really different than arcade games. Like, they didn't pressure you to go fast. It was like, think hard and make a decision, almost like chess. So I got hooked to that. Like, even though I was nuts about arcade games, I got hooked to the cerebral nature of these computer games. And then I found out that you could actually make them yourself by learning how to program. So I started asking around in the computer lab what these students were typing. Somebody gave me an HP basic manual, and then I could just spend all my time as much as I could on a terminal learning how to program stuff. So I made my first little adventure game when I was 11 at the computer science lab at the local college. So I went there like the whole summer. So I basically, when I was 11, I went to university and taught myself how to program. So I started doing that 3 years later after going to every store in town that had computers and was using them to program and all that. I finally got a computer in 1982 and then started making games. And the beginning of the game industry, people, if you look back in history, you'll hear about a lot of different publishers like Synapse Software and Broderbund and Sirius and Datamost and Datasoft and all these companies. These companies were all one person, usually like one or two people, and all the games they're publishing are from indies sending their games from their bedrooms. Like, they make their game in their room, send it to a publisher, the publisher wants to publish it, and then it goes out on stores and everybody has it.
But it's interesting that there were actually publishers, right? That there was like a certain infrastructure already available, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, so the way that publishers began comes from computer stores that sell the computers themselves. Because when someone comes to a store, I'm going to spend a ton of money on a computer. What can I do on it? Where's the software? You know, like they have to have software to buy. And so the people who are the managers running those stores are like, I don't own this store selling software, but if I made my own company selling software, I could make a mint because everybody wants this stuff. You can't have a computer without software. So a lot of the people running bike shops and computer lands back then, they left and started their own bedroom publishers, which then grew into big companies. And so they already had customers coming in. A lot of times, some of the customers were already programmers, and they would hook up with those programmers to get some of the first games that they published. So it was really grassroots at the very beginning. It was like computer stores selling computers, managers leaving to form publishers. The customers of those stores were the programmers that would become the indies that fuel the industry, right? So the entire game industry was fueled by indie developers at home. There was no such thing as a team of people making games. It was a single person always at home.
And it was not about money, I guess. It was just about fun, or?
It was about fun, yeah. You know, one of the really interesting aspects, people talk about mods today, and modding is a really big thing. It's really cool. People love mods. But people don't know that mods started when computers were even available to program. Universities, in fact, passed code around all the time for people to modify and put out a better version of something. Even the famous Colossal Cave Adventure from Crowther and Woods was Crowther modifying Woods' game, or the other way around. I think Woods modified Crowther's game. So it was a game written already on a VAX, and then another person who got the code at some other university modifies it, makes it into an even better game, and that's a classical version that everybody remembers. But games back then were modified and passed around. Mods were just part of the hacker ethic of free information and passing around code so people could learn and do cool things. It was absolutely freedom of information. It was everybody in was excited about learning how to code and make things on these new computers that people are going to soon have in their house. And so it started on mainframes in universities. And then when it finally came home to the house, there were things like Eamon Adventures, which was a basic skeleton. It was basic language. It was an adventure game skeleton that people would pass around on disks, just give it to everybody, fill out the skeleton into an adventure, and then copy that and give it to other people, and then they might modify it. So mods have been around since home computers and university mainframes and everything. Mods are just part of what people like to do. So when the industry started and you had indies who were making games at home, like Choplifter and Load Runner and you name it, all of the big games, those were single people at home making these games. They sent them in to a publisher that they heard about or thought might be able to do something good, like Richard Garriott with Akalabeth. You know, California Pacific Computer picked that up. Bill Budge, you know, he made Raster Blaster and other stuff before that, sends it to California Pacific Computer because he heard about it. You know, so it was like word of mouth. Seeing something on the shelf was like, that's the company I need to get in contact with to sell my stuff. So people, like, the grassroots stuff blew up really quickly, but still up until like maybe even the late 80s, the industry was still fueled by single coders at home making stuff. And then teams began.
And that is where you met John Carmack, or?
Yeah. That's so I met Tom Hall first.
Okay.
Well, geez, I guess even before that, Jay Wilbur was the editor of an Apple II magazine that I used to send lots of stuff to, and they would get published on all the issues. So I met Jay in 1986. Jay had a programmer working with him named Lane Roth. And Lane was the first programmer that I met that was actually a really hardcore programmer. Like, he was really good. And we met each other at the October 1987 Apple Fest, where Uptime had a big booth. And Jay was there and Lane was there. And everybody in the booth was playing my game that I had just published through Uptime. So it was really cool to actually be there and see that. And eventually, we get to SoftDisk. All three of us go to SoftDisk, and we're all working together. And it was great because you know, Jay was a technical editor, and he could program. And Lane Roth was a really great, programmer. And like, SoftDisk was full of coders. It was the first time I've met coders like this. And it was really, really fun. But what was neat was when I got to a point where I could start a disk called Gamer's Edge, and I could hire a team of people to make one thing, because I'd never done that before. So I found John Carmack, and one of his games was published on a disk that my game was published on. So we were both on the same disk. And I noticed he was really good from his game. It was called Tennis by John Carmack. And I could just tell from running the game that was some quality programming, And when I needed to hire, I asked the guys in the SoftDisk department, because I had Gamer's Edge, which was PC based. I said, I want to talk to this programmer. He's really good. And they said, yeah, we tried to hire him twice already. He says no. And I said, can you contact him again and tell him that it's only making games all day long that he'll be doing at this, then he's going to want to come talk. And so he did. He came down and talked to us, and we really hit it off because of how technical I was and how technical Lane was, that John finally met people that he could talk to, like, finally. Because it really was hard to find people who knew how to code back then, especially at that level of pure assembly language fluency. Like, it's just speaking English. Speaking assembly language is just like talking to people. So it was really great. So he accepted a job offer and came down, and it was really fun, because the first time that we worked on something, well, when we worked in the room together, the first thing we needed to do was I needed to make a game in 1 month, and he needed to also make a game that same month, so we could have two games in 1 month to put on a demo disc. So we had to go fast, and we did it. We both made a game in a month. We put on a disc that had a really nice bootable shell with text files, all this kind of stuff. And then when we were done with that, then we could actually start working on a game together. And that was such a critical point in everything that we did from that day forward. Because from that day forward, it was like, what do you want to do? I just asked him, what do you want to do? And he said, I'm interested in graphics programming and the program architecture. And I said, I will do everything else then. Game design, level design, tools, production, all that stuff, because I've done all of it for a long time. And that's how we started a team. That was how, like, we started working as a team. Lane Roth was in the room, so he was with us as well. Tom Hall was in the Apple II department. He wanted to come over and help because he loves making games. He'd made dozens already, so he was already like a big game developer. So it was just like a really great combo. We all came together and it just worked perfectly. And then I got Adrian from the art department, and he had the same kind of sensibility that we had. Like, we liked metal, we liked blood. You name it. He liked it too, And so we really got along well. And
it sounds like a really historic moment, right?
It was gaming.
I mean, it is like one of the key moments in the gaming industry, I guess, right?
That 1 month, unbelievably, September of 1990 was such a big month because of us working together for the first time, two major technical breakthroughs on the PC that led to a demo that we made for Nintendo to try to get Super Mario Brothers 3 published, you know, to actually get a deal with Nintendo to make that the PC version of Super Mario Brothers 3, and then them turning it down, and then we decide to make Commander Keen and we begin it. And all of that happened in September, along with a lot of other stuff happening in September. It was crazy. But we did. We started working on the Commander Keen series at night while during the day we're making another game. So we were always making two games at once for at least a year and a half. We made a lot.
How many energy drinks were involved?
Oh, that's all we drank. I drank Dr. Pepper constantly. John drank Diet Cokes. Tom, Diet Coke and Lane Mountain Dew. That's all we did. And we had pizza. You know, like, why? It's a waste of time going out and actually sitting down and eating pizza at a restaurant when you could be coding. Just order the pizza, you know? In fact, when we had, you know, we got our first publisher, Apogee Software, Scott Miller and George Broussard, right then at the same time. And Scott knew that we were making this game in our spare time, you know, after work and on weekends. So he would send us pizza money, and he'd send it to us. It's a check. It says pizza money on it. And that we're meant to spend that $100 on just pizza all weekend long. So that's what we did, you know, pizza and drinks. Like, that's what we couldn't wait for the weekend, because it was like, how long can we stay awake on the weekend while we're coding? That's what it was like making Commander Keen.
And how long was it?
Oh, man, it was basically like we got done. Like, we start work at 10 a.m. on Friday. We get done at 6. Everybody leaves the building. We take the computers out of the company, put them in our car, and then drive them to the lake house, and then stay up until 3 in the morning coding, something like that, and then go to sleep back at 10 a.m. And we do that every day, like 2, 3 in the morning, maybe 4, all weekend until Sunday night, because we need to actually sleep so we could be in the office by 10. But, you know, we probably went till 2 on Sunday nights, get back 10 a.m., or early than 10, because we had to get the computers back in the office before people came in. It's probably 8. But yeah, that's what we did to make that game, that trilogy of games.
And how much time did you have for Doom then? I mean, how quickly was that developed?
Doom was different, because with Commander Keen, we were working for one company while building our own next company, you know? So it was totally different than when we say made Wolfenstein, where we have our own company and we can do like all we do is code. Like, all we do is develop at that point. So with Doom, it was, you know, with Wolfenstein, we don't have a time limit. Let's just make a good game. And we spent 6 months total. Like, we spent 4 months coming from the idea of Wolfenstein to uploading the shareware version, and then 2 more months making all the rest of Wolfenstein so people could buy it, and hint books and all that stuff. So 6 months total for Wolfenstein. And then we made Spirit of Destiny after that. And we did, you know, did some stuff for the Atari Lynx and some other things. And then, in some design for Doom at the end of 1992, January of 1993 is when we started making Doom, and we shipped it on December 10th. So we had a year basically to make Doom, or like a year minus 20 days, 21 days.
And like, how many people were working on Doom then? It was just you.
It was mostly 5 people for the year. The last 4 months, we had one extra person. So the game shipped with 6 people working on it, but most of it was made with 5 people.
So the classical team of 3, right?
That is
like for myself, it's in development, it's like the best size you can have. really, like,
yeah,
3 people really focused, no excuses,
yeah,
just working on something and just forgetting about time, right?
Well, luckily we were in an era where we could have the most focus possible, right? There were no cell phones, there was no internet. We didn't have modems, right? This is This is the only communication with us was a house phone wired on the wall, and and no one knew the number. So we could just spend all day coding and developing all the time with nobody. There's no notifications, right? Those don't exist yet. Nothing to make you like look at Slack or something like that didn't exist. So it was like people wonder, how could you get so much stuff done? Because that's all we did. We didn't actually talk to other people over wires. You know, we talked to each other in the room and we kept on making things.
And did you actually earn money with Doom? I mean, it was kind of in a gray area, like in some countries it was forbidden, partly. It was shared as wares and so on. So did you actually earn money?
We made so much money on Doom. Of course, it was insane. Like, as an example, we made Wolfenstein. When Wolfenstein came out, like when we were still working on Wolfenstein, there was just four of us in the company, and we were making like about $50,000 a month off of Commander Keen. And Wolfenstein comes out in its first month without any ads. It made $250,000 just in 1 month without any ads. Right? And it just kept on going up, right? And then when Doom comes out, Wolfenstein's income was nothing compared to Doom. I mean, we're putting stuff out there for free so people could see it. It's a marketing effect. You know, like we put out our demo, the shareware version, which is an entire episode, and people liked it and they wanted to buy it, and they had to call a phone number and give a credit card even. But lots of people wanted it because, you know, they hadn't played anything like that before and they really liked it. So it went really well, you know. And putting stuff out there for free really works. You know, putting out a demo. Like there was no such thing as demo discs on magazines at that time. But they absolutely, other companies had to put demos out after we did shareware. Like absolutely, because they could actually see and play our game and buy our game and not buy someone else's game because there's no demo. There's a back of a box that you really hope is not a letdown when you get the real game. But with our game, there's no advertising. It's just download and run.
Crazy. So it was like a crazy marketing stunt at the other side as well. And you had like financial freedom with in which age then?
Oh, geez. Well, it was from the very beginning. Like the month that Commander Keen came out. As soon as Commander Keen came out in December 14th of 1990, 1 month after that was when we got our first check from Apogee, and we went, "We're quitting. Why are we working at Softdisk? This is enough money for us to live." So we did that. We started id Software immediately after we got our check. id Software was started 2 weeks after our check. And we, from that day on, we never needed to take investment or anything. We just kept on making money because we kept on making games. So it was immediate.
Crazy, crazy. And did you reinvest all of it into gaming or?
Yeah. All of our money went into the company. Like at the very, very, very beginning, just the first months, you know, the money was like going up slowly, and different people on the team had different needs for money. Like some people didn't need as much money as other people. So that's what we did. We gave each other whatever we needed. We didn't try to equalize anything because, you know, it's better to keep the money in the bank and buy better computers if we could. So we just gave each other the money that we needed to live. And that's how we got through all the really early bootstrap days. We didn't get to a point where like, all right, now we have to equalize all the money that we gave, you know, you, we need to get that extra back. We never did that. That wasn't what we were doing it for. We were doing it because we were doing really cool games and we wanted to keep on doing it. And it's funny because we never even thought about that. We didn't think about like, I want makeup cash or anything. It was like, I have enough to live and this is all I want to do when I wake up. So I'm happy. And we just kept on doing that.
And then you founded id Software together or?
Well, we did that two weeks after we got our first check. Yeah. id Software on February 1st of 1991.
And build your own gaming engine and everything. So, which is, I think, was already an investment back then.
Well, we did it in Commander Keen. So the game that we put out before we started in software was our first game engine.
Yeah, no, I mean like real 3D engine with Quake around the corner, which was, I think, the first game of id Software, right? Or was Doom already id Software?
Commander Keen was id Software in 1990.
Oh, really? Ah, really?
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of id Software like the era of Quake and later. Were you involved there in the
we made,
Quake thing still, or?
We made a bunch of games before we ever made a 3D game. Before we made Wolfenstein, in 1991, we made 10 games. You know, in Wolfenstein came out in 1992. We'd already made 15 games by the time Wolfenstein came out. And there are all kinds of different games: Rescue Rover, Dangerous Dave in the Haunted Mansion, Shadow Knights, Slordax, you name it. We made Hover Tank 1, Catacomb 3D, you know, Rescue Rover 2. We made a bunch of games before we made Wolfenstein. And that's not counting all the games we made before we even got together. Like, I had made games for 10 years before we got together to make the first games at id. So, as an example, Wolfenstein was game number 87 for me. That was my 87th. That was my 87th game. Yeah. So I'd made 62 games before, or 72? 72 games before starting id Software Games.
Wow.
So, and yeah.
How did the gaming scene evolve? I mean, in terms of game development and behind the scenes work, and not in terms of publishing and everything.
Well, tools. Nowadays, people use Photoshop, but back then, people used Deluxe Paint 2. That was the Photoshop of PCs back in the early days. And Deluxe Paint 2 was like a really important program because it could use all of the different graphic modes that the cards used back then: CGA, EGA, and VGA. Deluxe Paint 2 was a game. It was an original Amiga paint program by Dan Silva, and it was ported to the PC by Brent Iverson, who was actually an Apple II programmer before. And that was at EA. Brent was working at EA when he did that port. And EA even used to sell Deluxe Paint 2 with mice. They had mice made and branded with Electronic Arts. And we used to use those Electronic Arts mice all the time. Those were probably our first PC mice, were the Electronic Arts mouse. But yeah, people, we mostly used that to do art. And then we used Borland C 3.1 to do C programming. And before we did C programming, I had used Turbo Pascal on the PC and Turbo Assembler and Turbo Debugger to write all the assembly language code that I had done for the whole time I was programming on PC. Before that, on the Apple II, everybody basically used an assembler. I used Merlin. Some people used Liza. Some people did Orca-M. But there were a bunch of different assemblers on the Apple II, and that was what people used to make commercial software. The stuff that you saw on the shelf was made with an assembler. But then moving to the PC, where you could have a portable language like C, then you have to use a compiler. And so we started with Borland C 3.1, and eventually we moved to Wacom C 7.0 and Objective-C on Next Step. So that's what we did with Doom. With Doom, we decided not to use a PC for development anymore. So even though we made Doom for a PC, we didn't make it on a PC. We made it on a workstation called Next Step, the next computers from Steve Jobs. And that operating system is now OS 10. It's Mac OS.
Yeah, what to say? You were kind of Mac heavy, right? A Mac fanboy.
It's funny. I actually wasn't a Mac fanboy until they decided to switch to Intel in 2006. When Apple switched it to Intel in 2006, I became instant Mac fan. And then the iMac became something really great at that time. But from the Apple II to the Mac in 2006, that was PC the whole time. So from 19, 89 until 2006, I was PC. So 17 years.
Okay.
This episode is kindly supported by Fastly, the biggest challenger in the CDN market. Fastly is pushing ahead the technical boundaries and is, from my perspective, the best solution on the market. Fastly is known as one of the key drivers of the edge cloud movement. Well-known customers of Fastly are Shopify, the New York Times, Reddit, GitHub, and many, many more. If you want to try it all with first-class support, just go to fastly.com/alphalist.
I wanna deep dive a bit on a topic that I found interesting. Whenever I wrote you an email, you were actually working on a release and had no time. And I'm lucky that we do a podcast today. And I was curious how, like, agile processes actually shipped over to gaming. I mean, obviously, when you buy a box with a game in a store, then that's something that someone has to have worked on for years, and where, like, a lot of Q&A had to be part of the work, and a lot of hassling around quality. But how is it today? I mean, I as far as I understand, like, Romero Games is also doing a lot of software on Steam, which is not, I think, release focused. Maybe, like, the first release is important, but not as important as back then, right? You only had one shot, and that is very, very important in software. When you only have one shot, this shot has to be the right one. And how is it today? I mean, is the first shot still the right one, or the most important one?
Well, you know, it's funny. If you're making a PC-only game, there's a lot of different levels of release that is okay to go through, like early access type stuff, right? Like, now there's Steam playtest, you know, things like that are totally acceptable to get an early crowd in, with them understanding that this is not a release thing yet, but we'd love to get feedback. We did that with Quake. You know, when we were going to release Quake, it was 4 months before we released Quake, we put a multiplayer demo out called Q-Test, and everybody could play that and give us feedback. So we did it back then because it was something really important to get done. But now with Steam, you know, like, when you're looking at Steam as a consumer, as a person who just runs Steam and gets games, you see games that have launched already. But when a game is in development, we still use Steam from day one to deliver builds to the people that need to look at them. You just can't ever see it if you're a consumer because it's not launched yet. But pre-launch, there's a ton of builds of the game for people to get automatic distribution while they're in development. So it's also Steam is a development platform for us, right? And everybody else. So we can make a build of the game, push it up to Steam, and then everybody that we've allowed on our special list gets that version down on their computer and they can test it. So it's really, so
like,
really
like an iOS app or something, right? That where you have
test flight. Exactly.
Yeah.
Steam is like a test flight, except with Steam, you get to choose which version you want to look at. And we have probably 15 different versions of our games, you know, for different audiences. So and that's just to test certain things or certain times. Like, this version is just for making videos. This version is just for testing the balance of this one specific element, you know, things like that. So
like small A/B tests.
Just to test one specific thing. We just put some of these new things in the game. Here's a build just to test that. So we have stuff like that, because sometimes you don't want to disturb a main branch. Like, here is a beta branch. Well, we don't want you to the beta branch needs to stay there because there's people testing it. We have this other group of testers that just needs to test this one thing. And so they'll switch to that branch, and then the game will just auto download on Steam and they can just run that one. So there's a lot of really cool, I mean, development processes have gotten so much bigger than back then. Like, even up until Quake, and before Quake, we had no QA-ed software. There was no such thing. We didn't have milestones. We didn't have reviews where we would sit around and review the game. We saw the game on a daily basis. We're making it every day, and we're talking about it to each other constantly. So there wasn't, you know, sometimes we would have a meeting, but it was just like a company meeting to just talk about things in the company biz-wise that are happening, because outside of that, we are working on the game and talking about it constantly during the day. And the team was so small, we didn't need to have an agile or scrum process, which is still, I mean, obviously it's a super valid, very useful process. But because we'd been making games for so long, this was the way that we made them. And it was just natural to do it that way. It was just, we're just making it. And we are making sure that if we see a bug, we fix it immediately. So if we put the game out, no one sees bugs. And we're the coders. We know how to break our code better than anyone else. So we're going to try it. So we were just really thorough. We had no QA.
I imagine like part of your day was QA, right? You used to play like 3 to 4 hours a day besides coding. Is that correct? Or
Only after Doom came out. When Doom came out, then there was a bunch of gameplay. When we were making Doom, it was just all Doom, making Doom. There wasn't time to Deathmatch or anything like that. Deathmatch didn't get into the game until really late in the cycle anyway. It was basically just creating the whole thing. With Doom 2, we spent 8 months from beginning to ship on Doom 2. And during that time is when I played a whole lot of Deathmatch in Doom 1 and in the new Doom 2 stuff. But making stuff like Wolfenstein or making the Commander Keen games or Doom, it was all about playing the game constantly and knowing it and knowing if there's something wrong to fix it immediately right now. So that's how we did our own QA, because we're just playing the game to see if something worked. And by the way, as I was looking for something, I noticed this thing, fix it, boom, you know?
I think that's pretty comparable to the early days of web development and websites and web applications coming up. I mean, it's totally not comparable to as it is today. How did gaming change? I mean, how is it today in game companies? I mean, you're running a game company, you are developing games. Like, how many developers are involved in like a typical game? I mean, maybe something like a more indie game. How many developers do you need for that? And maybe then something like GTA. How big is the team? How is it organized?
Well, it's a massive range. You can make a team with one person. You can have one person make a game. You know, Minecraft was mostly made with one person. You know, the music was done by a different person, but other than musician, the composer, everything was done by Marcus just like the 80s. One person did everything. So you have those situations that are still happening. You know, if you spend any time in GameJolt or itch.io, you'll see a ton of games by one person, just hundreds and hundreds, thousands of games by one person. And they're being made constantly, you know, and one of them is going to be a breakout success. And then you'll hear about that person's, you'll hear about that person who did it. But games can scale from that to, huge teams. You know, I was working on an MMO that had 100 people in the office every day working on it, plus all the outsourcing that we had. It was huge. And the MMO never launched. You know, it was like, here's a game that we worked on for 4 years with 100 people, and it didn't launch because it's hard to launch MMOs. We had tech problems. But then, you know, you have people like the World of Warcraft team, which is pretty big. I think at this point, it's like 150 people on World of Warcraft, and that game's 17 years old. When you're talking about an Assassin's Creed, you're talking about thousands of people working on it. And that's basically different studios all doing a different part. So Ubisoft, you know, Paris will be like the flagship studio to start something. And then they'll have Montreal and all their other studios doing different parts of the game because the games are so massive. They have specialists in vehicles and specialists in riding, you know, riding horses. They'll have specialists in environmental effects, you know, like grass blowing and trees swaying. And so they have teams that can handle all these different parts. And it's just thousand, 1,500 people at least.
So there's like a head of toe development for the hero in the game, right?
Yeah, maybe.
only designing the toe animation. Yeah, and but is it? I mean, is there still like the secret successful hit games that have been there in the past in the 90s, still like coming out every once in a while? Like I mean, you mentioned Minecraft, which is obviously one of those cases, but
Valheim, have you heard of happening? That? Have you heard of Valheim?
No.
It's massive. The developers made like $45 million within weeks of the game coming out. This is just like a couple months ago. Yeah, the industry, it's huge. It's called Valheim.
Valheim, okay.
Yeah.
And this still happens, right?
Unbelievable. Do a Google right now. Look at Valheim. You won't believe it. This is and the game is really fun. It's a really great game made by five people. It's a great, Valheim. Huge indie success story. Okay. You see?
And those are all published for Steam independently? So is it all like...
Yeah.
Indie stuff or?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Five people, indies, made that game, put it out, boom, cash.
But I guess chances that they deliver another hit is kind of close to zero, right?
No. I mean, they could, but they don't need to now.
Yeah, but I'm just asking because this is like a, I think, a theme in gaming, right? That you develop one hit and potentially won't have another one. I mean,
it is difficult. It depends, though. Like, one way that companies try to ensure that they can deliver another hit is by staying in the same franchise that they just created with the hit, right? So if they do a sequel to that thing, there's a high chance of success with the sequel. Like, we made Doom, and Doom 2 was even bigger. It sold it outsold Doom 1 easily. And in Doom 3, if it would have come out even earlier than 2004, it would have sold a ton. You know, like, people were waiting for that sequel. So it's like a franchise. Call of Duty, Battlefield, you name it. These are sequels in a franchise that just keep on making money. They're hits, right? And they're hits because they're staying with the formula. If you change your formula because that's what you want to do because you're a creator, then you risk not being able to hit the same thing. But you know what? If you make a lot of games, you're going to do a lot of experimentation and figure out what works and what doesn't. Because, you know, Wolfenstein was probably the first game that I made that was on a massive scale like it was. And that was my 87th game. And when Minecraft hit, that was Marcus's 28th game. When Akalabeth hit, that was Richard Garriott's 28th game, right? So there's no overnight success for people that haven't done anything.
Yeah, you guys are so crazy. I mean, 80 games, one person. And if I wanna start now developing games, I mean, do I still need to be able to code in depth, or do I just need to know JavaScript and need to get an engine somewhere, or what is the like minimum viable setup to build games these days?
If you want to build a game by yourself without programming, you would get the Unreal Engine and use blueprints, and you can make an entire game like that. You wouldn't have to code. You would just use blueprints.
Just clicking or what?
Yeah, you basically go into Unreal and you go to the marketplace, the Unreal marketplace, download a ton of assets, characters, environments, all this stuff, start building a scene, getting the character in there, start making blueprints for things the character can do, and you're making a game. And you didn't have to code.
And you don't no longer build an engine, right? You just
if you want to, you can. I mean, if you want to get into the engine licensing business, you would. If you're interested in making games, you would license an engine.
Do you build your own engine or?
No way. That's not worth it. I would get nothing out of that. I'm not making a game so I can make an engine. You know, I want to make a game. I need an engine to make a game. So if I can get an engine that can do the things I need, I want that engine. So I can focus on just making the game. And the easier it is for me to get to the game, the more I want to use that engine. You know, so there are people, and anybody that is starting out and is starting to write an engine should get a job at a company writing an engine. Right? Because there's companies that like Unreal and Unity, they're making their engine all day long. Get on the engine team, go get hired somewhere, you know, learn how to do it the right way. But that's for, like, anyone who's going to start and wants to program an engine is interested basically in writing an engine, not making a game.
I imagine, yeah. So I would assume, like, John Carmack and you somehow have a split in between, which says, yeah, one of you is interested in writing the engine and one is interested in and optimizing latency and one is interested in the content and building the game, right?
Well, the thing is, we're both interested. I think that we're both interested in all of that. Because back then there weren't engines. They didn't exist. You had to write everything from scratch every time you made something. So you either copied your old code because it worked, or you're gonna write something new because the hardware changes so quickly. So you start figuring out how the new hardware works and make some new stuff, you know? Back then, back in the 80s and the early 90s, you had to write your own engine. You had to do it all yourself. There wasn't anything. Every pixel that you saw on the screen was put by you yourself. There was no graphic cards that could put pixels on the screen. There was no GPUs. It was you putting a number in memory that represented a color on the screen as a dot. That's how our games were made. And so when you see Quake even, as a 60 frames a second super fast shooter, every dot was put there manually by our code with no GPU involved because they didn't exist. So we had to know how to do that, and we needed to know how physics worked, and we needed to know how state machines worked, and we needed to know how networking worked and everything. I mean, it was a ton of
stuff. I mean, just how you differentiated in a way later on, right? I mean, John is still doing... Like I think he's still CTO of Oculus, right? And you are now, is he not?
No, he left Oculus. He's still interested in VR, but he's basically working on AI.
Ah, okay, interesting. So I think I have to get him into the podcast as a next guest. Maybe you can introduce me later on.
Yeah, he won't do it. He won't do it.
No, I guess so. Yeah. So I still have like two topics left, and we don't have too much time. One question I've left, or the last real question, is how will game development look and the game industry look in 10 years from now?
Well, I think people are still going to be using... I can't see the... source control changing too much. There might be some better stuff out there. Perforce is pretty much the best right now. You're going to see definitely more advanced versions of Unity and Unreal and maybe something new. It takes a huge effort to try to compete with those engines. So if something new comes out, it's got to be tailor-made for a new segment or for a new type of developer that... You know, it's going to have to be made for a specific thing. I can't even imagine right now, but it'll happen. You know, like things come out of nowhere. You can guarantee that things will come out of nowhere that you didn't expect. So stuff might alter development, but Agile's been around for a really long time. Source control's been around a long time. Photoshop's not going away. You know, like better graphics, sure. There's ray tracing, ray marching. There's a bunch of different techniques. There's a lot of procedural generation that's going to be handed off to GPUs and you know, video cards. So there's stuff like that happening, but it's not drastically changing the nature of development. Like we're not replacing programmers and artists and writers yet with procedural generation.
So no Matrix, right?
Not yet.
Okay. And then coming to my last question, which is a little surprise for you. John Carmack recently contacted me and sent me a top secret version of Quake 1. And I actually installed it on like a very, very, very old dusty laptop I had laying around somewhere with Windows 95 on it.
Yeah,
and then I started up the game, and there's like that console already in Quake 1. which you can use to type God. But I like, he sent me a message and said, type in / time travel Romero 1993. And this actually makes you time travel to 1993 and lets you observe the young John Romero, who's like in the final phase of developing Doom 1. And yeah, a lot of nighttime scenery, a lot of energy drinks and so on. And you observe yourself for a while. And we now have the chance to whisper something into young John's ears. What would it be?
It would be, I'm trying to think of how I would say it. With Quake, like, after Doom 2, you need to split the team into new engine development and the next game team. That would be the advice.
That would have been a game changer, or what?
That would have been, well, that would have probably kept it, you know, its software from breaking after Quake.
Okay.
There would have been another game out before Quake.
Okay, great. Thanks, John. Cool. Thanks. It was really, really nice talking to you. And we actually made it like perfectly in time.
Awesome.
And I'm looking forward to welcome you soon when COVID is over in Hamburg again, or
nice.
Let's meet up somewhere. And looking forward to your next game releases. So maybe want to shout out your latest release or something, like just as final words.
Yeah, Empire of Sin has been out since December. We've done a lot of great releases and additions to the game. Just check it out. It's actually really, really fun. Very deep game.
Okay. So I myself will, after checking out Valheim.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, John, and hope to see you soon.
Cool. Thanks. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You too.
Thanks again to our sponsors, Fastly and the About You Cloud. If you want to know more about Fastly services, simply visit fastly.com/alphalist. If you want to get in touch with About You and hear more about the About You Cloud, simply write to hello@aboutyou.com. Thanks a lot.